from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. It's Monday morning's political roundtable, and this morning, lots to talk about with Michael Wolff's political expose, Fire and Fury, hitting the shelves. President Trump felt compelled to describe himself as a, quote, very stable genius over the weekend in response to the book's portrayal of him as an incompetent and dysfunctional leader. And we'll hash through as much as we can, including the latest on the Russia investigation and last night's very political Golden Globe Award ceremony and Oprah Winfrey's stirring speech.
So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon.
Is Oprah running? Stay with us after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Michael Wolff threw a literary grenade into the White House and America's newsrooms last week with the release of his new political tell-all, Fire and Fury. It has had tongues wagging all weekend, wondering what's true and what's not, and most importantly, what the political fallout will be. Beyond that, there's a whole lot of other political news to talk about, including new details about Robert Mueller's investigation and last night's anti-harassment protests at the Golden Globes. With us for the conversation is Amy Allison, president of Democracy in Color, an organization focused on race and politics, which works to elect leaders with a social justice agenda. And welcome, Amy Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Lonnie Chen, who joins us by phone this morning, research fellow with the Hoover Institution, former policy director for Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. And we welcome you to the program.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Good to have you. Also good to have Anita Kumar, White House correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. And welcome, Anita Kumar.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you all aboard here. And let me begin, if I may, Amy Allison, with you. Oprah Winfrey received the Cecil B. DeMille Award last night and gave a very stirring speech. For those of our listeners who didn't hear it, it reminded me in some ways of the speech that Barack Obama delivered at the Democratic National Convention and has had that kind of effect, stirring a lot of talk about her as a presidential candidate. But before we even get to that, I wanted to get your take on just what kind of effect you think this is going to have. All these people turning out in black, many stars talking about Me Too and talking about a new day and a new dawn and so forth. What do you think is going to happen as a result?
It's a profound political and cultural era that we're entering. And I can't express enough that sense when I was hearing her speak of being both reflected and seen as a black woman, but also the movement and what it could mean for this year's politics is pretty amazing. And, you know, I have to say, you know, Oprah Winfrey really reached back into a deep social justice and political history in this country by calling the name of Racy Taylor, by talking about Rosa Parks before the Montgomery bus boycott, and by articulating women's need and demand to be heard in fairness. And I think we're seeing a new articulation of a politic that's fueled by women of women and led by women of color. You got to remember, last January in the Women's March, everyone wore those hats. That was really about a president who had just been elected who openly bragged about sexual harassment. And that, along with that history, has formed a foundation where it's been a buildup over time through Me Too to that speech. And it's been a long time coming and very exciting about the actual political possibilities. Because that hashtag Oprah 2020, people are like, oh, that's, it's just, you know, a celebrity. It's, you know, is actually, if we do the math and we look at what's happening in this country, we could actually see it is not that crazy right now to imagine a black woman as president in 2020. So she opened up a lot of possibilities for a lot of us.
Let's actually hear what some of, at least, what she had to say in her speech last night at the Golden Globes.
So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight, and some pretty phenomenal men to make sure that they become the leaders who take us to the time when nobody ever has to say me too again.
Well, Amy Ellison, you mentioned a new political day, a new cultural day, but you also alluded to the fact that there were all of those women marching. And in many people's judgment, that was one day. And then where was that picked up afterward? In other words, what I'm getting at here is what's going to happen as a result of what happened last night?
This is, you know, it's first of all, when Oprah, I got chills just hearing her voice again, because it was just this amazing call for courage and conscience in a nation where we've really been assaulted on a daily basis for challenges for fundamental democratic civil society and decency, how we treat people who are part of society. And the reason I say that is because the marches happened last January, but organizing has been consistent. 2 months ago,
Hollywood raised how much money?
Right. But that's only the latest. But a couple of months ago, the Women's Convention in Detroit convened over 2,000 women, very multiracial group of women articulating this kind of politic, highlighting some of our heroes, looking at women. And I focus on women of color because we have many women, black women, and other women of color, and including those who led the Women's March, who are now creating a platform and organizing and preparing women to actually play politics in their local areas all over the country.
So you definitely see political action here.
In fact, I will say on the 21st in Las Vegas, the same Women's March organizers who held the Women's Convention a couple months ago are now doing a big conference called Power to the Polls, where they're organizing women who have been active in this movement to turn out the vote, register, support people who are reflecting this kind of intersectional, courageous politic. So we are in a cultural moment where powerful men are being held to account. We're also in a political moment where we're going to see way more than the Anita Hill. Remember, Anita Hill sparked the first wave of women that kind of came into Congress. The first black woman was elected. We're going to see if that was a wave, this is a tsunami in terms of the political power of women and women of color asserting themselves at the polls in 2018.
And Oprah as a candidate for the presidency?
I mean, you know, honestly, people are like throwing that out there. She's so inspirational, but it's not crazy. And let me tell you why. Black women, for the first time in my 25-year political history or experience, were acknowledged after the Alabama results. It was black women, only 7% of the population, in a state that Trump won 2 weeks before the holidays, who came out for him, 98%, and were the swing vote. Oh, my goodness, people realized that black women were a factor. Now, those of us who study it, and I've been working on a book for—
You mean came out for Doug Jones.
Coming up for Doug Jones, excuse me, and defeated an accused child molester. Here's the thing. It's not just Alabama. Black women, for the last three presidential elections, have been the highest vote turnout group of any race and gender. And they have been swing votes in places like Virginia, the gubernatorial in 2017, and the gubernatorial in New Jersey. And when we look forward to 2018, my goodness, if you have the kind of focus, and it was an independent effort in Alabama, but if there was a kind of focus in maximizing the most, what I call the most staunch progressives, which are black women, in the country, who vote at the highest rates, they can turn elections in places like Florida, places like Georgia, even in a place like Maryland, where
traditional red states.
Black women can be the swing vote in term and a very important leader and core of a multiracial kind of the Obama coalition in the modern day for the Democrats to win back. So when you ask me, is it crazy for Oprah to be considering a run? It's not only not crazy, I believe that if the Democrats embrace this kind of courage and conscience and really look at the base of the party, which is half people of color, you could have a candidate win, someone like Oprah or someone like Kamala Harris or the senator or another very exciting alternative to what we've got in the White House right now.
Again, Amy Ellison here with us in studio as president of Democracy in Color. And Lonnie Chin is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, former policy director for Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. And presumably Mitt Romney is going to be running for Orrin Hatch's seat as Utah senator. That seems to be a foregone conclusion, doesn't it, Lonnie Chin? I just want to get to you on Oprah for in a moment, but...
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it's a foregone conclusion. I think that he's considering it. Obviously, I think there are a lot of reasons in my mind for him to run if he decides to do that. But I think that obviously with Senator Hatch stepping aside, there is an opportunity. And certainly with all of the issues we face as a country, you know, Mitt Romney's someone who's spoken out on a lot of these over the last couple of years. And certainly during his presidential campaign, I think he'd be very good if he decides to run. So we'll see.
Well, let me ask you to assess, if you could, what the result or the reaction is going to be to what we just heard from Amy Ellison. I mean, not only a real, shall we say, spirited movement among black women, but among people of color and among those who are in the Democratic Party who may indeed see Oprah Winfrey out there campaigning, if not for the presidency, for other Democratic candidates. White House taking this seriously, do you think?
Well, I have to imagine at this point they're taking any serious challenger seriously. I mean, this is one of those situations where we realize that we're in a different political moment now than we'd been for the last several years before President Trump took office. And that political moment is one where really anybody with any background, and I don't mean that pejoratively, I mean, you know, people who don't have a previous political background can very much be in the consideration for the highest office in the land. And I think it's a very serious set of discussions. I thought Oprah's speech last night was very compelling. And in a lot of ways, she presents much more of an exciting possibility for Democrats. And I'm not one myself, but presumably for Democrats, much more exciting than other potential candidates. So I think that there is an opportunity here for her. I think there's an opportunity for people who support her. And so in that way, I think indeed it should be taken seriously.
Well, Tom Steyer has said he's going to make an announcement today. We are waiting on that. I don't know what it means. If he's going to be in the running or running perhaps for senator or governor of California. But Anita Kumar, let me get you to weigh in on this. It seems to be that there really is some profound buzz about Oprah candidacy here.
Right. I think that one of the reasons we're hearing so much buzz right away is because although there's probably 10 or 20 people on the Democratic side that are being talked about for running in 2020, that none of them really stick out at the moment. You know, none of them is at the forefront, perhaps maybe Joe Biden, but other than, or Elizabeth Warren. But other than that, it's a lot of people that don't have the name recognition, can't raise the money that she could. So I think they're looking for someone. And I think that speech resonated. I think they realize she has the name. Everybody knows Oprah. She has money. She could raise money. And I think that's one of the reasons is they don't have a go-to person right now, and they have about 20 people right now. So I think that's one of the reasons.
Well, let me make an announcement here, because Tom Steyer said he was going to make an announcement today, and apparently he has. That he's a Democratic donor who, of course, has been leading this impeachment campaign against President Trump and has spent more than $100 million since 2016 on political campaigns. He's going to forego any run for office this year and focus instead on ending Republican control of the House of Representatives. Anita Kumar, some thoughts?
Sure. I mean, we were kind of waiting for him to announce what he was going to do, but he's definitely going to be a force out there. We've definitely seen his ads here in Washington and heard from him. So I think, you know, whether he runs or not, I guess he's not running right now, we're still going to hear from him, and I think he's going to be a factor out there.
And let me hear back from you, Lonnie Chin, on something else that is very much in the news, and that's the Michael Wolff book. And we can talk more, of course, about Oprah's candidacy. I'm sure we'll hear from some listeners on that, or about what is the result of what we saw last night at the Golden Globes and heard at the Golden Globes. And it wasn't only an impassioned speech by Oprah Winfrey, but by many other really movie stars, is the only way to describe Laura Dern. And we also heard a speech by Barbara Streisand and a number of others who spoke very passionately about the Me Too movement and about the changes that needed to be made. In fact, after Oprah gave her speech, Natalie Portman got up and said, well, here I'm talking with Ron Howard about the nominees for directors, and they're all men. But I wanted to get some thoughts from you on the Michael Wolff book, Lonnie Chin, and particularly in light of the fact that, well, it seems to have not only stirred things up, to put it mildly, but It seems to give a picture of the Trump White House of the only way to describe it is not only chaos, but incompetency and unfitness for office. I mean, you had 100% of the people, according to Wolf, who has been questioned in terms of his journalistic bona fides and just how much authority ought to be given to him. That's a whole other element to talk about. But there seems to be agreement among many people that the Trump White House is in disorder and disarray, and that Trump is not really fit for the job.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency, certainly amongst people on the right, to want to completely discredit Michael Wolff, on the left, to sort of embrace everything in the book. I think that the better posture, as you've suggested, is to say, what does the book tell us about the kind of administration that we're looking at? What does the book tell us about the kind of White House we're looking at? And surely, the even if every single factoid in the book is not true, and there's reason to believe that every single one isn't true, there is a picture that's painted that is clearly very disturbing. Now, bear in mind, a lot of this picture was painted before the current White House chief of staff took office, but certainly the kinds of disruptive figures in the White House, people like Steve Bannon, who obviously has been a lightning rod out of this book, the types of individuals, the way in which business is done, the direction that the decision-making processes are headed, these are all things that I think are problematic, and they're issues that are raised by the book that I think people need to look at and look at seriously. And certainly, I think that's the reason why the White House has been so concerned about the book and has pushed back very hard, including an interesting interview, which maybe some of your listeners saw on CNN yesterday, between Jake Tapper and Stephen Miller, who's a senior advisor to the president. That kind of pushback, I think, is indicative of the fact that the White House is concerned about this very point, which is, what kind of portrait does it paint of what's happening there? And I think that's the most important takeaway, rather than any specific anecdote, which, while interesting and some of them, while quite juicy, maybe have less import than the throw weight of the book and the portrayal overall.
Well, does it in effect cast Steve Bannon out of the picture to a much greater degree, where his influence in the White House was in many ways paramount? Now he's being called Sloppy Steve by the president. The president is showing a great deal of anger because, at least according to Michael Wolff's book, there were pejorative remarks about his son, about his daughter, about his son-in-law. To some extent, Bannon is trying to walk this back, but can he? Mitch McConnell, by the way, must be the happiest one of all in all this.
Oh, I think there are a lot of people that are quite happy about Steve Bannon's downfall. I think that the reality is that Bannon can try to walk some of this back, but we've always known that for Donald Trump, the red line is his family. That if people begin to somehow criticize, or in this case outwardly accuse, his family of wrongdoing, that's a red line that simply, once crossed, cannot be taken back. And so I think for Steve Bannon, he probably made a decision that cost him the support of the president.
And not only the president, but Rebecca Mercer, who was the main funder
exactly.
of Breitbart.
Well, yeah. And in some ways, that might be more important for Steve Bannon, and certainly for his enterprises.
Well, here's Michael Wolff on CBS this morning. Actually today, and he was asked about the 25th Amendment. That's, I may remind listeners, the constitutional provision by which the president could be removed from office if he is deemed medically unfit, and about whether there are people inside the White House talking about trying to remove him from office. Let's hear.
There are many moments in which the 25th Amendment has come up, the 25th Amendment in which gives the cabinet the ability to remove the president. And they don't say the cabinet is going to remove the president, but they do say things like, this is a little 25th Amendment here.
Nita Kumar, any possibility that the 25th Amendment looms here directly?
Sure. I mean, he sort of walked it back a little bit. I see he's, and he's been doing several interviews. He acted as if they were talking about it all the time, and now says they're worried about people talking about it. I don't know. It sounds like he's changed his tune a little bit on that. You know, I mean, I'm over there all the time. I don't know that they've got a lot of things that they're worried about. I'm not saying it's never come up, or probably it has come up, but I just don't know that it's the thing that they're talking about all the time. And I think that him walking it back a little bit means that he realizes they're probably not. I mean, just going back to what we said about Steve Bannon earlier, it's so interesting. I was talking to someone who's close to both the president and to Steve Bannon, who was saying, just give it time, give it 6 months or so, and he'll probably be back in the fold. This president has a way of criticizing people. I mean, look at Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. You know, they got into a huge, they're back and forth just some months ago, and now they're pals. Today, the president's going to Nashville, and he's taking Senator Bob Corker with him of Tennessee. And if you remember, they got into it, for months now. So he has a way of inviting people back in into the fold. So I don't think we've seen the end of Steve Bannon.
I wonder, Amy Ellison, if I go to you on this, Jim Fallows, who writes for The Atlantic and who is probably one of our best political journalists, talked about this in light of Harvey Weinstein. Interestingly, he said it's an open secret that Donald Trump is, Michael Wolff portrays him, an unstable personality, unfit for office, and this will give that even more heft.
You know, so much of our energy and analysis goes into trying to understand the bizarre machinations of what's going on in the White House. It's such a departure from what we think is has decorum and seriousness. When we talk about the power of the movement that we're seeing, we saw expressed in Oprah's speech, just think about the fact that we have a president who hasn't been held to account or been held responsible. So I think you're one of the things that we need to keep in mind is what people are really hungry for is not just looking inside the White House and trying to figure things out, but holding people to account and looking for people who are going to say, you know, time's up. Here's, you know, be responsible, because we didn't need this book in order to know that some things were happening that were not okay with us in the country. And Bannon represents, I mean, Breitbart is openly racist and attacks people. And it represents a kind of politics that is such a departure from what the possibility in this country is. Personally, I would much, much rather spend our precious energy figuring out how to elevate and expand the democracy, because this kind of thing is what keeps people away from the polls. It really does.
I wonder also, though, because you talk about keeping away from the polls, Anita Kumar, is this going to be more difficult and keep journalists out of the White House? There's been a good deal of talk about how Wolf had access, at least to some degree, and there's going to be a great deal more suspicion now. Certainly, President Trump has attacked the Fifth Estate over and over again, but one wonders if this will make it even more difficult to get access. And there was an article, in fact, in Gentleman's Quarterly about how too many journalists were sort of throwing out crumbs against Trump but afraid that they weren't going to get access. Some thoughts, Anita Kumar, before we go to a break?
Yeah,
here?
Sure. I mean, before he was even sworn in, I think we were all really worried just based on his rhetoric that, you know, reporters wouldn't be allowed into the White House. We wouldn't be traveling on Air Force One. You know, there wouldn't be the access that there has been. And, you know, none of that really happened in terms of the logistics. Now, you know, we're still there. We still have a workroom. There's still a briefing every day. We're still flying on the plane with him. So none of those things really happened. I think what has happened and probably will happen even more so is that there's a lot of suspicion at the White House about what they say and what they can say. I mean, they're not.
Nita, excuse me. I'm going to have to interrupt you because we are coming up on a break, and we'll get back in a moment. But I want to give out the phone number in case listeners want to join us and talk about not only the Michael Wolff book, but talk about what happened last night at the Golden Globes and Oprah Winfrey. You can join us toll free. The number to call, 866-733-6786. That number is available now, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments you might have on your mind there, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but please feel free to join the program. We're talking with Anita Kumar, Amy Ellison, and Lonnie Chin. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking politics this hour, both local and national, and looking for your thoughts on the Golden Globes, the Wolf book, and the news of the day. We're going to get to DACA and a few other things here in the course of this hour. We are with Anita Kumar, who is with McClatchy Newspapers, and Amy Ellison, who's here in studio, is with Democracy in Color, and Lonnie Chin, who's a research fellow at the Hoover Institution and was former policy director of the Romney campaign. I want to go back to Anita Kumar, though, who was finishing up a thought about access of journalists. And it just occurred to me also, Anita, I want to hear your finish your thoughts that you were bringing forward, but also there was a lot of complaints during the Obama administration about lack of access, too.
Right. Yeah, I was just, what I was trying to say is that logistically so far we haven't seen much of a difference, right? The reporters are still at the White House, they're still on the plane, they're still traveling, and we've seen that. What I worry about with the book and what is, you know, we've seen over the last year in 2017 is that, you know, that the Trump advisors and staffers aren't really very forthcoming, right, with the reporters who are there, and they don't provide very much information. If you've watched the daily briefing with Sarah Sanders or with Sean Spicer before that, you know that they're not giving out too much information. But you make a great point, which is during the Obama administration, there was sort of the same. We were there, we were on the plane, we were in the White House, the briefing was happening every day. But they also tried to keep things keep information from us. And I think that's just White Houses, right? Doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or a Republican. Generally, administrations want to get out their message, and they're going to do everything they can to put out what they want and keep everything sort of close in. So, yeah, you make a very good point.
Well, a number of listeners make some points here. Let me just read a few of them in comments that are coming in. Robert says, we don't even need these latest revelations to show us the character of the president, which has been plain to see for years by anyone with eyes and ears. And Mark writes, Oprah for president. Are these people out of their minds? Electing one unqualified celebrity as president isn't enough. She has absolutely no political experience. I know Amy Ellison will want to respond to that, perhaps, but here's Merrily, who says, I hope you mentioned that the Women's March is happening again this year on Saturday, January 20th, all over the country. Locally, there are marches in San Francisco, San Jose, and Oakland, and I suspect many more. But what about that lack of political experience, Amy Ellison?
The election of President Trump changed the game. What is experience? I'm trying to make the case that someone who puts a positive vision, that brings people together, provides leadership, is what's sorely needed. Now, I'm not saying that that's the panacea, but I'm saying she got a lot of people excited. It's not just a speech. And if you just focus on Oprah, you're missing the point. It's about the new political era that's being led. It's a multiracial coalition we call the New American Majority, but it's being led by Black women because they have the conscience and the courage, and also the votes. So it's missing the point. I really think that it's not just about Oprah. It's about Black women as political players really coming into their own.
Here's a thought, though. I've got a listener on here. Let me get to him first because he's right on point here, and that's Kevin from New Brunswick, New Jersey. Kevin, welcome.
Yes, hi.
Hi. Go ahead, Kevin. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I was calling because I was thinking about the possibility of overrunning in 2020 and how she actually might diffuse a lot of the criticisms that could be leveled against her by a Trump reelection campaign, because she, you know, is also an entertainer. She also doesn't have the political experience, as you were just saying. But at the same time, you know, those criticisms would not really be valid against her, although that, as we've seen, doesn't always stop the Trump administration from making them.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin, for that point. Well, the field, I think Amy said, is maybe in a different era now as well because of the Trump presidency. There are people talking like Mark Benioff and Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, no political experience on those scores either, or for that matter, Tom Steyer. Just a quick thought here, though, Nita Kumar, there is at least a sense that Hillary Clinton, for whatever her defects may have been or her difficulties in terms of gaining the presidency, also had a difficulty carrying on the Obama legacy, because that was pretty much what both Barack and Obama and Michelle Obama candidates were in favor of with respect to his her candidacy. I mean, they went out and spoke about her and this is our legacy, carry it on and so forth. But the Trump presidency was a real backlash to a lot of that. Now, looking realistically, how much of that backlash and how much of that base is still there?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. You were right. I mean, it was sort of an anger in the country and anger about Barack Obama and sort of the way the country was headed. So it'll be interesting to see in a couple years where things are. I mean, if that still resonates and that will be helping him. Obviously, he'll be in office for 4 years, so, you know, it'll be running on his record at the point. It'll be a whole different ballgame then. I mean, he'll have to run on his record and say, here are all the things I did that I said I would do. Here are all the things that I, you know, changed in Washington, if he's able to do those things. So it'll be a whole different way of running. He won't be able to sort of look back at how he did it in 2016.
Well, maybe a little premature to talk about presidential races, but LaWanda says Michelle Obama should run. I love her. Both Michelle and Oprah are wonderful. And here's another caller. And Dan, you're on.
Yes, hello. I have a comment and then a question.
Go ahead.
I don't think we're in a new political era. I think we're in the same old political era, which is power is never granted. It must be seized. And we are witnessing American women and women of color in this country seizing power, and I welcome it. I'm very, very happy about it. It's about time. Another problem, which is though that Oprah does have no political experience. I welcome her joining the fray. I think she should run for something less than president for the obvious reason of, sure, it may not be a deal breaker that you could have someone with no political experience holding a very powerful office, but it's risky as hell. My question is, moving on to the risk there, Donald Trump this past weekend, oh boy, what a show. I know young people, I know a lot of them, many conservatives, they're getting really turned off by the Republican Party. People are saying this, David Frum saying this, polls are showing this. I'm wondering, have we reached a point of no return? Has the millennial generation been soured on the Republican Party? Are they going the way of the Whigs?
Well, it's a good question. Let's hear Lonnie Chen on what you think about the Republican Party, which is quite ascendant now, controlling both houses of the legislature and the executive. But millennials are rebelling against it and a lot of concern about Donald Trump. What do you see, Lonnie?
Yeah, I mean, this has always been the challenge, is that in the short run, or at least where we are now, Republicans, as you've suggested, are actually doing fairly well in many places, state legislatures, state governorships, both houses of Congress. Now, the question is how long that can continue, if actually what they're doing is they are swimming against a demographic tide. And it certainly seems, with respect to millennials, that there is an opportunity for a conservative or a center-right party to make some inroads. You know, I spend a lot of time on college campus, and what I see is that there are a lot of millennials who want to see that alternative, but the Republican Party is not pitching itself as an effective alternative right now for any number of different reasons. Donald Trump may be part of it, but there's also the broader question of the policy that the Republican Party more broadly is espousing. So it's not that I think the Republican Party is dead. I think that the Republican Party has so many institutional advantages. In other words, there's so many reasons why it's easier to run as a Republican than an independent in many parts of the country. So the Republican Party is always going to have some role. The question is whether it is going to be so ineffective in the future because the bargain they've made is success now rather than success later. So there are some serious questions to be considered here, but I don't see the Republican Party going away anytime soon.
You don't think that the tax reform or whatever way you want to characterize it is going to hurt the Republican Party in the future? Because it's certainly not necessarily reaping the benefits, even though things are pretty good on the stock market, admittedly, but not necessarily reap the benefits that have been promised.
No, well, I think in the short run, the tax bill will actually help the Republicans because, you know, many middle class families, I do think, are going to see some relief over the next couple of years. The question is what happens in the long term.
That relief is provisional.
But the question is, are members of Congress really going to allow that relief to expire when it's scheduled to expire? But that issue aside, the bigger problem is, have we created a huge deficit? And is that something that's going to come home to roost at some point and hurt the Republicans? I think that's the bigger issue.
Well, it is a bigger issue, particularly because the deficit is becoming behemoth and it's going to have to be dealt with, presumably, in some way, and Paul Ryan is already talking about entitlements being the way. But let me get back to something that's very much in the news here, and it actually cuts into what we're talking about now. And let me go to you on this, Anita Kumar. Just let's talk about DACA, because there's wrangling going on about defense money. We've got a few days left before it may all come crashing down. And the reality is that the Republicans want more money for defense, but the Democrats want DACA, and a few Republicans want DACA.
Yeah, for a while there, I thought things were going pretty well on Capitol Hill with negotiations, and then you saw that on Friday, I think, word leaked out about this wall, the wall that the president wants to build, you know, that he's talked about on the southern border, and how much money that would cost. It actually wasn't a surprising analysis at all. We've heard different numbers over time, very large numbers, but I think it just kind of put a damper on things, so we'll see how it's going. You know, they have until the 19th, which is not very long, less than 2 weeks now, to get this to get this package all together. I'm hearing now in the last few days that there's talk about doing another, you know, quick fix, a CR, until next month, and as they continue to try to find a more longer-term solution, a longer-term spending bill. So they might keep pushing it off for a while, which they tend to do.
Now, let me go to Amy Allison on this. And, Amy, I think you're aware of this. There was an announcement just today, and I want to make it for listeners, that nearly 200,000 people, 200,000, mind you, from El Salvador, who have been allowed to live in the United States under the temporary protected status for more than a decade, must leave the country. The government officials announced this just today. So, I mean, we've got that and DACA and all the wrangling that's going on. How do you see this proceeding?
Well, first of all, just to take a moment to appreciate how terrible it is to withdraw sanctuary status for 200,000 people from El Salvador and the impact on their families. They've been reading stories that this is my home. And you have to ask, why is this happening? Why is this a priority for the Trump administration? And we are seeing unprecedented attacks. So we put the DACA issue in the broader political perspective. A vote on the 19th that does not include a provision for DACA for these young people who came as kids to stay in the country is a vote to deport them. And if
which has already been done, excuse me, to Nicaraguans, has already been done to Haitians.
It's a vote to deport them in a country where we're sitting here in San Francisco. California is a majority people of color state, as of six others. The country is almost majority people of color, and that's fueled by people from all over the world, particularly South America, Central America, and Asia. And if we look at that, that is the makeup of our country. There are attacks. So any Democrat, for example, who is not crystal clear that they would be, if they don't insist on DACA, they would be deporting these young people. Some are in college, UC Berkeley or other places. We need to be clear not only from the political calculus of what DACA is, but from the moral calculus and what this means for our country. So, for example, I know there are organizations like Forward.us who are bringing 125 DACA recipients to Washington, D.C. right now. In the next 2 days, they're going to be meeting with about a quarter of congressional members to make their case. But we're coming down to the wire, and this is a really, really big test for Democrats, for sure. I mean, there are a few Republicans who I think are on the fence, but for Democrats to stay strong and make a stand for DACA, now that's what we're going to be watching for as well.
Actually, I've got a question for you, Amy, specifically from a listener named Jay. Jay, go ahead.
Good morning. My comments are directed to Amy Allison. I would like to say politely that I think you make the classic mistake of perceiving the electorate as being comprised of white people on one side and people of color on the other side, because that implies that we people of color are just this one happy, homogenous family who all think the same. And there are so many languages and cultures and religions throughout the continents of Asia, Africa, India. And to think that all that gets thrown out of the window once we get to America, we're just people of color. I think it's inaccurate to think that way. And I'll close the point by saying that I'm a Muslim American, and we Muslims, we're closest to the Christian faith. And if it wasn't for the rhetoric that comes from the Republicans, I would probably align myself with the Republicans. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for that statement.
And just to respond, first of all, I appreciate that, because one thing is we are a multiracial, multiethnic society. And when I talk about people of color, really we're talking about the new American majority. Those are people who elected and reelected Barack Obama as being the majority of voters in this country. And not everybody of any one group all thinks the same. But if we take an aggregate, we can look at how there's a percentage of white progressives plus higher percentages of people of color in various groups, and it varies by group, that tend to vote more on the Democratic or progressive side. And so it's not to suggest a monolith, but it is to suggest a new way of looking at our electorate. And to tell you the truth, Democrats don't necessarily look at their base that way. And my argument is that if they do, they'll start winning because they then can start speaking to and reflecting this multiracial reality.
And let me get back to DACA with you, Lonnie Chen. If the Democrats take a stand on DACA, will they or the Republicans get blamed for any government shutdown?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to see how Republicans don't get the blame for a shutdown just because they're in charge of everything. And I mean, this has always been the dynamic from the start, which is why Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan have been insistent on trying to get to a deal. And I think it's very, very difficult to see a scenario where they don't get blamed for it. Now, the reality is that there may have to be some fig leaf in there for the president's priorities, because it's impossible to envision that at some point he's going to continue signing off on these temporary spending deals that don't include some measure of funding for his policy priorities. But I do think the politics of this are very treacherous for Republicans and in an election year, no less.
Let me bring another caller on here, and that's Gabby from Oakland. Gabby, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I wanted to make a comment. So I am a former DACA recipient. I now have a residency, which is great. But I just wanted to kind of point out the stigma that's happening again about learning disabilities. I was reading a couple articles and mentioning how Trump is on a fit that he may have a learning disability in the new book that came out. You know, I think that as a person who also is DACA, who also has a learning disability, I think that when we see those type of things in the news, again, it focuses on the stigma. You know, I have a college degree, but it's been a hard process for me to get a college degree because of my learning disabilities, the different stigma that happens with that. But I think that he is unfit to be president because of his actions and how he demonstrates to create more problems by taking away DACA, you know, the whole Salvadorian thing that happened today. You know, he is hurting American values, and I think that it should be more focused about his actions. And, yeah, that's one of the reasons why he's unfit, because of all the crazy things that he's doing. And I think that should be more the focus instead of, again, this whole aspect of people with learning disabilities being in the news again, and that he's unfit because of that.
All right, Gabby, I much appreciate your comments and thank you for them. I'm going to read some more listener comments here, listener tweets. There are 307 Democratic women running for the U.S. House so far. Full stop. Tsunami is right. And Morgan writes, Oprah for president's a wonderful idea, but let's not stray from all our progress. There are plenty of other more qualified women, Kamala Harris for one. Oprah can do so much more for the masses from where she is now. And by the way, several listeners have mentioned Senator Kamala Harris as a possible candidate for the presidency or for a run for the presidency. And let me go back, Anita Kumar, to you. And this is a usual potpourri of news stories. And as is often the case, and I should say almost always the case, there's no shortage of news stories to focus on. But I'd like to get your take on what the president and his team of lawyers is actually going to do about the possibility of having to be interviewed by Robert Mueller, or for that matter, Mueller's team. They're talking about, maybe some kind of compromise, I guess, to avoid an interview, have questions sent to them that are written questions or some kind of affidavit. What do you see?
Right. I mean, this is where the negotiation, I guess the lawyers are negotiating, because they'll have to see what they can do. I mean, it would be extraordinary if he was interviewed. You know, they have said from the very beginning, the White House and the Trump's attorneys, that they are fully cooperating, that there's nothing here. So, you know, from a publicity standpoint, obviously they want him to continue to show that they're cooperating and that there's nothing going on. But yes, he's a sitting president, so there's a lot of negotiation going on. And, you know, there has been for some of these high-profile people that have been interviewed by Mueller, but also on Capitol Hill and the congressional inquiries, you know, whether something's public, whether they put out statements, you know, how it works, it's behind closed doors. Obviously, all those things are happening. And so, yeah, it's very, very interesting, and it's very distracting, I will say. You said there's no shortage of news, and you're right. I think about 20 big things happened last week, and yet, you know, there was mostly a distraction by this book, right? So I think that there's news every day on the Russia investigation, and that is really hurting them. It's taking away from the White House and their policies, and they want to get it done. They just want to be done with this.
Well, just a thought from you on that, maybe, Anita Kumar. I think it was Robert Reich. I may be wrong, but he's not the only one that's made the speculation after the book by Michael Wolff came out. There are those who are saying this charge of collusion sort of presupposes that there was some kind of conspiratorial action taking place, or shall we say, machinations of a conspiratorial sort. And although no one will take away from Donald Trump's ability as a businessman, despite his bankruptcies, there are those who say, how could he have had the attention span to have brought forth this kind of collusion? I mean, what people are saying in the White House, they're comparing his attention span, you know, to a flea and all sorts of rather, shall we say, derogatory and pejorative things of that sort.
Right. Interesting. This week, I don't know if you recall, but I think it's on the 12th, which is Friday, the president's supposed to undergo a medical exam. And the White House says that they will release information about that. So we are kind of waiting at the White House. But yeah, it's an interesting point. You know, but it's not just him. It's people that it's what he directed, or if he directed anything, it would be part of his staff. It would be family members. I mean, it's not that a person has to be in charge and be doing every single thing. It's what the person directed to do. Now, we have no idea, at least I have no idea what that is. But yes, the book did bring that back to the forefront.
You have to ask, though, the president, last time he had a medical examination, the doctor and people who work for Donald Trump do say the most superlative things imaginable about him. He says them about himself as well, of course, but he said he's the healthiest president we've ever had, which is remarkable because I didn't know how this doctor had medical records of, say, Chester Arthur or James Garfield or James Knox Polk. But he is having a physical on Friday, and one has to ask, you know, are we going to – too many presidents have kept their physical – and maybe one might argue mental states a secret and have kept that from the public.
Yeah. What's interesting about this is that they say that it will be at Walter Reed, the military hospital here. So that will be interesting that, you know, you mentioned his personal physician. Presumably this will not be that person and it'll be somebody else. Also, they haven't said what they're going to release. They've just said that they will release something. So it's unclear sort of, is he really going to release all these details that we saw with, you know, for example, President Obama? It's pretty unclear.
Here's a thought from a listener named George, and I'd like Lonnie Chen to get your response. He says, the ongoing Republican agenda will have profound effects despite the apparent weakness of this administration. Keep your eyes on the ball rather than the antics.
Yeah, you know, well, it's you know, I might not characterize them as antics or characterize them negatively, but I do think that there are a number of things that the administration is doing and pursuing that are long-time, long-held conservative policy priorities. Certainly, the tax bill. You look at what they've done on regulatory reform, appointments to the federal judiciary, which is something we don't talk about too much, but is a 30 or 40 year game changer in many cases. And add to that potential further action on the Affordable Care Act, and I think you have a pretty systematic dismantling of the policy priorities of the last 8 years. So, yeah, this is a significant change that I think people can lose sight of, given their focus on what's happening in the White House.
There's also drilling plans off the California coast. There's also the appointment of P. Daniel Smith, which kind of went under the radar as deputy director of the National Park Service, which is a major appointment in many ways. And we may get into that later on in the week when we talk about some of the environmental things that are going on. But George, whose statement I just read, also says he says talks about dismantling of the State Department and EPA, removal of regulation on public lands, stacking the courts and so forth. That's kind of the ongoing Republican at least agenda as we see it. Do you, Lonnie Chin, do you think essentially that they're going to be able to get through a lot of this, and particularly get through with infrastructure, which has been kind of hovering around the discussion all along here?
Yeah, I mean, infrastructure is an interesting one because this was always seen as an opportunity for bipartisan cooperation. I don't know if that's still the case, given how rancorous the last year has been. But what people oftentimes don't realize is how much policy change can be effectuated through the administrative state. You know, President Obama did a lot of this during his time in office, and now President Trump is using the administrative state to his full advantage, and that speaks to issues like offshore oil drilling, like the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, like many other environmental issues that frankly go through the organs of bureaucracy, if you will. And so I think that is an opportunity for this administration, and it's one that they've used to quite full effect.
Another comment about Oprah. She had exactly the same experience and qualifications as Arnold Schwarzenegger when he ran for governor, and more than Ronald Reagan. Actually, in I think it was 1999, Donald Trump said he was asked who he'd like to have as a vice president candidate if he ran for president. He was in a different party at the time, and he said Oprah Winfrey. let me bring another caller on here. And Dusty, that's you. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for this show. And with much respect for Oprah, I wanted to put Cynthia McKinney's name out for people to research her. McKinney, I think, like now, Nney.
Former congresswoman, yeah.
Yes, former congresswoman from the state of Georgia.
Correct.
She's an African-American woman. Please research her, Cynthia McKinney. There is a movie called American Blackout that is a documentary, not like a fictionalized reenactment, a documentary where you see her, and it's about, did I just say black voter suppression? You see her, you see Cynthia McKinney laying it down on the floor of Congress, all these white guys trying to suppress her, and she is speaking truth to power. So she has got the political experience, and she's got a really good heart, too.
Well, you're talking about Cynthia McKinney. Maybe somebody's going to bring up the name Maxine Waters, too.
I was just going to say Maxine Waters. I'm reclaiming my time.
Actually, let me ask, because we got very little time left, I want to ask you, Amy Ellison, and all of our other guests, what are the big stories you're following this week?
I'm looking at, well, first of all, Erica Gardner's funeral is today. And this young woman experienced the death by police hands and died very young. And it's to me a continuing focus on how racism kills. She was also a victim of domestic violence early in her life. And this is an opportunity to really look at where we are not and how we haven't made enough progress on police violence.
Okay, let me leave it there and go to you on this, Sunita Kumar. What are you looking at this week?
Sure, I'm really looking at this immigration deal, the spending bill deal, including DACA. The president this week is having Democrats and Republicans over to talk about a DACA fix, so I'll be looking at that. And also his medical records on Friday.
And Lonnie Chen.
The future of the Iran deal. The president has to make a decision regarding the reimposition of sanctions potentially by January 12th, and that will be a very big deal with respect to the Iran agreement as well as the future of our relationship with that country.
Well, let me extend thanks to all of you for the good coverage we've done this hour. Thanks to Lonnie Chen, Amy Ellison, Anita Kumar. Thanks to you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, but we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And when we come back to Forum, we're going to talk about the new report on the Oroville Dam, and we're going to talk about jellyfish. Stay tuned.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.